Our sermon this evening is again a topical one. And our topic is loving those you disagree with in a pandemic. We'll consider a number of scriptural texts together this evening, but we'll begin our time together with 1 John chapter 4, verses 19 through 21. Please listen carefully. This is God's word for us this evening. The Apostle John writes, "We love because he, that is God, first loved us. If anyone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, whoever loves God must also love his brother." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Let's pray together. Lord, you have called us to love one another as you have loved us. We ask you would help us to better know from your word what that looks like for us right now in this time and in this place. Grant this, we ask, for your tender mercy's sake. Amen. There are people in this congregation, and this isn't speculation, this is fact. There are people in this congregation, heavily involved in the congregation, who, while they might disagree with some things here or there, on the whole, they think that Governor Inslee is doing a great job. And they're thankful for the shutdown and for the stay-at-home order and for the cautious approach that he's taken. These people right now are more worried about our state opening too quickly than they're worried about it opening too slowly. And they've been extremely frustrated by how President Trump has handled things at the federal level. There are also people in this congregation, and this too is fact and not speculation. There are people in this congregation, again, who are heavily involved, who have strongly disagreed with the way that Governor Inslee has handled things. They've actively protested his orders. They want the shutdown ended immediately. They've urged organizations to defy the order in some cases, and they've been very supportive of President Trump's approach to things at the federal level. Now, as I describe those two groups, if you responded to either one, either description by thinking or by saying to the person next to you, since you can do that if you're at home, I guess, if you found yourself thinking or saying, how can anyone be so stupid as you hear those descriptions? How can they be so blind and naive? How can a Christian be so morally compromised as to take up that perspective? I don't know what to do with people like that. It kind of drives me nuts, actually, that there are people like that even in our congregation, because honestly, I'd rather not have much to do with them. If that at all, and maybe not to the same degree, but if to some extent that resembles your response to one of those groups when you hear about them or you think about them, well, that's what we're going to be talking about this evening. And if you find yourself somewhere in the middle on these topics, this will apply to you as well. You don't get out of it. Because every person I've talked to so far has some strong opinions about what's going on right now. Everyone is worried about something. Everyone is also mad about something, it often seems. Everyone is looking with blame at someone. Maybe for you it's not a leader, but it's that person who came closer than 6 feet to you without asking. Or it's that person who asked you to put on a mask before walking into a certain building or store. We live in a time of cultural division, and it did not take long for us to fit this pandemic into that same mold. Tensions are running high. And the fact is that it is not us in here against them out there. The fact is that the lines of disagreement run through our congregation, whether we realize it at this point or not. But the Apostle John says to us that if we do not love our brothers and sisters in Christ whom we see, then we cannot love God whom we have not seen. Whoever loves God must also love his brother. And so tonight I want us to begin to consider what it will look like for us to love those we disagree in the midst of this pandemic, both how we will love one another within our congregation and also how we will love those outside the church. To do that, I want to look at five ways we're called to love those we disagree with. I want to look at how we are to love in the way that we seek knowledge, how we are to love in how we evaluate costs and benefits going forward, how we are to love in how we use words with and about those we disagree with, how we're to love in how we act around those we disagree with, and finally, how we are to love in how we lament with those we disagree with. That's what we'll be considering this evening. And so with that said, let's dive in. First, I want us to consider together how we are to love in the way that we seek knowledge. Proverbs 18:17 says, "The one who states his case first seems right, until the other comes and examines him." This first point might sound like it has more to do with wisdom, and it does have to do with wisdom. In fact, we may come back to it in a future sermon on wisdom. But it also has to do with love. When we think of arguments in an abstract sense, this proverb can seem to mainly be relevant for gaining abstract knowledge and truth. But when we think of it in terms of relationships, we quickly realize that it has to do with love. Hear it again. The one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. Now imagine applying it to one friend who comes to talk to you about another friend. Do you see yet how it has to do with love? We have a tendency when someone comes to us to tell us just their side of a disagreement to take what they say at face value without first hearing what the other person has to say, without first letting someone else question or even dispute the account that we've heard. And if we do that with one friend talking about a second friend, then we're failing to love that second friend. We're believing claims about them without first hearing a different perspective on what may have happened. And this can be an issue even when no one's trying to deceive anyone else. Everyone's perspective is limited. Everyone's perception is shaped by a number of things. Everyone may need the gentle correction of another perspective. The one who states his case first seems right until another comes and examines him. Failing to consult other perspectives, failing to allow others to question the perspective that we hear, this is not just folly in terms of determining the truth, but it's also a failure to love others. And it's a pattern of seeking knowledge that we are very guilty of in our culture right now. And so most of us have our preferred sources of information, and we consult them first, and they seem right to us, and then often we stop there. Or we only go on to consult others who agree with that first source that we considered. And far too often, we never consult another perspective that will examine the first one that we heard and liked. That's a good way, of course, for us to remain ignorant, but it's also a good way to be unloving. Because as you follow that habit again and again, you won't just remain ignorant of where your preferred sources of information might be wrong, but you'll also become dismissive of anyone who would say that your preferred sources of information could be wrong. You will not be able to think it reasonable, in fact, that anyone would seriously question your preferred sources of information. And you will then fail to love people. You will fail to love those leaders in our culture, whether in government or in the media or in the business world or in some other position of power. You'll fail to love those leaders whom your preferred sources of information are critical of, because you'll never even consider that those leaders might not be as bad as maybe you're being told. But in addition to that, you'll also fail to love the people around you who have a different perspective than you do. You'll fail to love them because you'll be critical of what they believe before you've even given it a fair hearing. And if you do engage in a conversation, you may not even truly listen to others because you'll have grown accustomed to really listening to just one perspective. Now, we need to appreciate that this is true whether your preferred sources are CNN, the New York Times, and NPR, or whether your preferred sources are Fox News, National Review, and Rush Limbaugh. The point is not that you should be listening to every source or perspective that's out there. Of course, that would be impossible and a waste of time to try. But the point is that you should be listening to some solid sources from a perspective that will cross-examine your preferred sources of information, to some perspective that is different from your own. Listening to perspectives different from your own, allowing other sources to cross-examine your preferred sources, helps you to be humble about what you believe. Because it will show you that the arguments that you've heard and agreed with, and that you might still agree with, maybe it also helps you realize, though, that they're not quite as airtight as you might have wished that they were. Listening to perspectives different from your own, allowing others to cross-examine your preferred sources, will help you see that in many cases, a well-intentioned, reasonable, and intelligent case can be made for a perspective that is very different from yours, even if you still think that perspective is wrong. Listening to perspectives different from your own is a way of loving those that you disagree with. How we seek knowledge and how we love those who are different from us are two things that are, in fact, connected. Where do you need to consider how you will better love those you disagree with by how you seek knowledge? That's the first thing to consider. Second, I want us to consider together how we are to love those we disagree with and how we evaluate costs and benefits going forward. And here's what I mean by that. Every way forward in this pandemic from where we are right now has costs and benefits. And in every possible scenario, those costs and benefits fall unevenly on people. In other words, we can tend to think of the costs and benefits of different approaches to the current situation in purely individualistic terms. We think of the possible economic costs versus the possible health costs for me. But in no scenario is there a simple cost and benefit result that is the same for every individual. In every possibility, some groups pay higher costs and others receive greater benefits. When we only think of the costs and the benefits to ourselves or to people that we know or are close to, then we have a tendency to only see, to only pay attention to the costs and benefits that will fall to people like us. But other people face a different set of costs and benefits. And to ignore those is not a loving way to evaluate what we should do next. In Philippians 2:3, the Apostle Paul writes, "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourself." That means that in all things, including what we should do next, we need to consider and to think about and to take seriously the range of costs that will fall on different people in each situation. We need to weigh them in any position that we advocate going forward. And even if after those considerations we have the same perspective that we did at the beginning, how we hold our position and how we view other positions should be different. Let me explain what I mean. If you are a white-collar worker who can work from home or in isolation and you favor extending the stay-at-home order, have you also really considered the worker who can't work from home, who maybe depends on an hourly wage and who is facing economic costs to the lockdown that you are not personally facing? Or on the other hand, if you're a white-collar worker who can work from home or in isolation and you favor an end to the stay-at-home order, have you really considered the fact that while you will still be able to maintain good social distancing in your job, other people may be quickly put in close proximity with others at work once the order is lifted, and they may have serious concerns about what that may mean for their health? If you own or run a business or an institution or a department and you prefer that the order stay in place right now, and you're not worried because your organization has the funds available maybe to wait this out a bit further, have you really considered the fact that other leaders are concerned that their organization might go under, or that they won't be able to keep paying their employees, or that their clients will be deprived of something important that they provide, and that those worries might be behind their desire to open sooner? Or if you run some sort of organization and you really want to open things up sooner, Have you considered that leaders of other organizations are genuinely burdened by the idea of having to make major decisions for their employees or their clients' health and safety? Decisions that they may feel wildly unqualified for and want someone else to make for them, out of concern for what is best for others. If you're someone right now who's comfortable at home with your family, and you'd prefer that the order be extended just to be on the safe side, have you considered the person who lives alone and who is terribly lonely and who may be beginning to struggle with their mental health? Or if you're someone who is healthy and wanting to get back to work, do you consider that there are others who have factors that make them more vulnerable? And once their employer opens up again, they'll have to go back right away, despite the risks it may present to them, or they could lose their jobs. After all, we need to remember, for all of the talk of freedom in our culture, every option will take away some people's desired freedom. Closing down takes away freedom of some to work, and opening up takes away the freedom of others to stay away from work until the risk to their health is lower without permanently losing their jobs. But there are people facing a countless range of circumstances right now. Some are anxious to get back to work because they are afraid about feeding their family. Others are anxious about being required to go back to work because they may bring the virus home to a vulnerable family member. Every path forward has costs and benefits, and every path forward puts more costs on some people and more benefits on others. We could, of course, go on and on with such examples. And by listing all of these situations, I'm not actually arguing for one position over another. But what I want you to see is that in some situations, the benefits to you will be bought by greater costs to others. In other situations, greater benefits to others may be purchased by greater costs to you. Now, it may be fitting and expected in a pagan society for each group to fight for their benefits and to unthinkingly foist the price of their benefits onto someone else. But that's not how Christians should approach these issues. We need to take the costs that our benefits will put on others seriously. We need to seriously consider when the loving thing to do is to take the costs onto ourselves in order to love our neighbors. And then, even if we do advocate something that ends up being for our benefit, even if we advocate that because we still believe that that is the best thing for the greatest good, we should then be especially humble towards and thankful towards those who will pay greater costs for that plan of action. We need to respect them. We need to appreciate what that means for them rather than dismissing their concerns or pushing them aside. We need to love those we disagree with in how we evaluate costs and benefits of how we might go forward. Third, I want us to consider how we are to love and how we use words with and about those whom we disagree with. How are we to love those we disagree with our words in this situation? In the ninth commandment, we read, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor." James, reflecting on the nature of our language and our words, adds that with our tongue we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth comes blessing and cursing. My brothers, he writes, these things ought not to be so. The Westminster Larger Catechism, part of our denominational standards, summarizes the Bible's requirements for our speech under the umbrella of the ninth commandment. It's a long passage in the Catechism, but I think it's worth reading right now. Listen to what it says in two questions and answers. Question 144, what are the duties required in the ninth commandment? The duties required in the ninth commandment are the preserving and promotion of truth between man and man and the good name of our neighbor as well as our own, appearing and standing for the truth, and from the heart sincerely, freely, clearly, and fully speaking the truth and only the truth in matters of judgment and justice and in all other things whatsoever, a charitable esteem of our neighbors, loving, desiring, and rejoicing in their good name, sorrowing for and covering of their infirmities, freely acknowledging of their gifts and graces, defending their innocency, a ready receiving of a good report and unwillingness to admit an evil report concerning them. Discouraging talebearers, flatterers, and slanderers. Love and care of our own good name and defending it when need requireth. Keeping of lawful promises, studying and practicing of whatsoever things are true, honest, lovely, and of good report. And now question 145. What are the sins forbidden in the ninth commandment? This one's a bit longer, but hang in there with me. The sins forbidden in the ninth commandment are all prejudicing the truth and the good name of our neighbors as well as our own, especially in public judicature. Giving false evidence, suborning false witness, wittingly appearing and pleading for an evil cause, outfacing and overbearing the truth, passing unjust sentence, calling evil good and good evil, rewarding the wicked according to the work of the righteous and the righteous according to the work of the wicked, forgery, concealing the truth, undue silence in a just cause, and holding our peace when iniquity calleth for either a reproof from ourselves or a complaint to others, speaking the truth unseasonably or maliciously to a wrong end or perverting it to a wrong meaning or in doubtful or equivocal expressions to the prejudice of the truth or justice, speaking untruth, lying, slandering, backbiting, detracting, talebearing, whispering, scoffing, reviling, rash, harsh, and partial censuring, misconstruing intentions, words, and actions, flattering, vainglorious boasting, thinking or speaking too highly or too meanly of ourselves or others, denying the gifts and graces of God, aggravating smaller faults, hiding, excusing, or extenuating of sins when called to a free confession, unnecessary discovering of infirmities, raising false rumors, receiving and countenancing evil reports, and stopping our ears against just defense, evil suspicion, envying or grieving at the deserved credit of any, endeavoring or desiring to impair it, rejoicing in their disgrace and infamy, scornful contempt, fond admiration, breach of lawful promises, neglecting such things as are of good report, and practicing, or not avoiding ourselves, or not hindering what we can in others, such things as procure in ill name. Now, that was long. I'd actually encourage each of you to sit down and look over those questions and answers from the Westminster Larger Catechism at some point later this week, if you can. Questions 144 and 145. They're convicting. The dominant pattern in our culture, though, more and more runs counter to the patterns that are set out here in the Catechism, that are based on the Scriptures. And both sides of our culture can be guilty of it. David French had a really good article back in February titled, "The Church's Real Political Correctness Problem." It's another thing that would be worth having a look at this week. French argues that both the secular left and the religious right are guilty of their own versions of political correctness. It's not, he argues, that there is one for political correctness and the other that is against it. Rather, that they have different rules and different codes, but that the underlying pattern between them both is the same. Both value how communication is done more than what is actually communicated, though one values delicate inoffensiveness while the other values harsh provocation. Both have a cancel culture in which they completely dismiss someone and try to take them down for a viewpoint that they don't like. Both tend to stoke and exaggerate anger at the faults of their opponents while ignoring the faults of their allies. Both have a system for quickly labeling someone and then dismissing them so they don't really need to hear what they say. And so on one end, once you're labeled bigoted or ignorant or phobic in some way, then you can be safely dismissed and ignored. On the other end, once you've been labeled as woke or pearl-clutching or virtue-signaling or a snowflake, then you, too, can safely be dismissed and ignored. Similar to the patterns that we noticed this morning, this is another area where we have two opposing sides that seem to be secretly allied against what is good and right. Because the Westminster Divines would say that both of them are guilty of breaking the Ninth Commandment. Now, step back with me for a minute from the cultural debates and think just for a moment about yourself. And let's consider what the Catechism says. Consider first what it says about how you respond to those you agree with. Who do you find yourself agreeing with at this moment about the pandemic? Who maybe in the political sphere, or who in the sphere of the media, or who among those you have personal relationships with? The Catechism reminds us that to love those whom we agree with, to love them well, we need to be careful, it says, to avoid flattery, to avoid unjust fond admiration, or to avoid thinking or speaking too highly of others. It says we fail to love our allies when we are unduly silent when their iniquity calls for a reproof. As the book of Proverbs says, a man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet, and a flattering mouth works ruin. When your friend speaks falsely or does wrongly and you flatter them, you're not helping them. When someone whose opinion you generally like speaks or does wrong and you defend them wrongly and you speak more highly of them than you should in that moment, then again, you do wrongly and you do not love them. Instead, we're reminded here that we're called to lovingly speak truth to our allies. As we hear again in the book of Proverbs, faithful are the wounds of a friend. Sometimes we need to lovingly confront our allies and those we agree with on our current situation. But the Catechism has even more to say that's relevant to how we respond to those we disagree with. What does it mean for us to love them in how we speak and in how we hear? Again, take a moment to think about who falls in this category for you. Who are the writers or the media outlets or the politicians, the people maybe that you know at church or online who you disagree with, and who you disagree with about how to handle and how to understand the current crisis that we're in? Bring those people to mind right now. How does the Catechism say that you are to love them? And how are you to hear and to speak to them and about them? How are you to love them with words? Well, it says in the Catechism that we must be ready to receive a good report about them and resistant to admitting an evil report about them. It says we must refuse the unnecessary discovery of their infirmities or the raising of false rumors about them or the eagerness to receive an evil report about them or the stopping up of our ears against a good report of them. It says we must avoid evil suspicion of those that we disagree with. It says that when a report comes to us and it seems to be true regarding some fault in them, then our response should be to sorrow over their infirmities and not to rejoice in their disgrace. It says that when we speak about those we disagree with, we should freely acknowledge to others the gifts and graces that God has given them, rather than denying the gifts of God and grieving when they do well. It says we should seek to have a charitable esteem of others, that we should love, desire, and rejoice in their good name rather than aggravating and exaggerating their smaller faults. It says that when we speak to others about someone, we should refuse to tell tales about them, to scoff, to revile, to speak rashly or harshly about them, and to be prejudiced regarding their reputation. Instead, it says we are to strive for the truth between ourselves and others and to promote the good name of all. It says that when others engage in talebearing and slander, we should speak to them and we should discourage them. Now, as I went through all of those examples, all of those applications for the Catechism, my guess is that somewhere in the middle of that list, many of us stopped thinking about our own failures to do this regarding those we disagree with. And we shifted to thinking about how others have failed to do this when they interact with those that we do agree with. Now, if you made that shift somewhere in that list, then you need to stop and turn your attention back to how you treat those that you disagree with. How do you treat them with your words, both how you speak and how you listen? Whether the public figures or with public figures or with your neighbors, or with your family members, or with your fellow congregants, how do you speak to them over the phone or online? How do you speak about them to others? How do you speak about them with your closest friends or your own spouse in your home? Historian Peter Brown records how Augustine, when he was a bishop, had a warning against gossip in the form of a short poem, and he had it written onto the table at which he did all of his hospitality. It's recorded on at least one occasion when a guest began to gossip about someone who was absent. Brown writes, Augustine upbraided them so sternly that he lost his temper and said that either they should rub those verses off the table or that he would get up and go to his room in the middle of the meal. Imagine if we too were so concerned with loving others by what we spoke and by what we would agree to hear. Again, none of this says we shouldn't disagree with others or disagree strongly. Instead, this is about how we disagree. Where does love require you to speak and to listen differently to and about those you disagree with? Fourth, I want us to consider how we are to love and how we act around those we disagree with. When disputes arose among Christians in Rome about foods, Paul stressed that while there were right and wrong answers to those questions, whether the Christians in Rome acted in love in those areas was far more important than which camp they fell into and what they ate. He writes, "Let us not pass judgment on one another any longer, but rather decide never to put a stumbling block or hindrance in the way of a brother. For if your brother is grieved by what you eat, you are no longer walking in love. By what you eat, do not destroy the one for whom Christ died." When a somewhat parallel issue came up in Corinth, Paul writes, "If food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble." Now, the situation that Paul was dealing with there was different in many ways from the situation that we face now. But still, there's an underlying principle that goes between them, that's shared. Love for our brothers and sisters should be more important than those things that we disagree on. What does that mean for us? Well, it means that if you're concerned about practicing social distancing, then you'll need to be patient and gentle with those who you hear are not practicing it, or who you see are not practicing it, or who are suddenly invading your own 6-foot buffer without your permission. Now, again, that doesn't mean that there's no place for you to challenge them or to disagree with them or to have a discussion with them about it, but it does mean that even as you do, you have that discussion in love. It also means that if you personally think that the lockdown or social distancing or masks are unnecessary, then when you see or hear of others who are taking those things seriously, and individuals or institutions who may ask you to practice them when interacting with them, then you'll respond in a way that is more concerned with loving your neighbors and being sensitive to their conscience and their concerns than with asserting your rights around them. And once more, that doesn't mean that there's no place for you to challenge their level of concern or to have a conversation about that. But it again means that even as you do it in love. You stand 6 feet away from them, or you wear a mask as you explain to them why you don't think it's necessary to stand 6 feet away from them or wear a mask. This is what love in our actions looks like, even as we disagree. Fifth and finally, I want us to consider how we are to love and how we lament with those that we disagree with. In our country right now, there is a lot of disagreement about what is going on and about what is the best way forward. But one thing that we should all be able to agree about is that a lot of people have died. And a lot face other hardships right now as well. Even if there's debate about how many deaths or how the deaths are being counted, a look at the overall deaths per week this year in comparison with the average deaths per week in previous years looked at by country or by state makes this fact of these extra deaths undeniable. And a look at unemployment applications in the U.S. or food lines around the world shows the economic impact that people are feeling as well. People are dead, and people are in need. Strikes me in some ways that it's sort of like the stereotype that some men often express any negative emotion that they feel as anger. there's that stereotype that's out there. Of course, it is a stereotype. It's not true in every case. And yet, at the same time, we all know men who, if they feel any negative emotion, they seem to express it in the end as anger. Sadness is expressed as anger. Shame is expressed as anger. Embarrassment is expressed as anger. Fear or anxiety are expressed as anger. For some men, anger is the only negative emotion that they feel safe expressing. And so every other negative emotion has to be turned into anger and expressed that way. It makes them less able to express what's really going on in their hearts. It also makes them less able to come alongside and to have sympathy or empathy for those who are suffering. I was thinking this week that in some ways it seems like our culture in the U.S. right now has become a lot like a man who needs to turn every negative emotion into anger. Whenever something happens, we as a culture seem to turn it in one way or another into anger. Sadness is too scary for us. Fear is too scary for us. Uncertainty is too scary for us. And so we find a way to make any problem or any loss grounds for anger at someone. And this pandemic is no exception. It didn't take long, but everyone's angry again. And when we do that, we become less compassionate. And we often fail to love those whom we should be loving. And yet the Apostle Paul commanded us to be people who weep with those who weep. Peter Lighthart on this theme writes this. It's long, but it's worth hearing. He writes, "Let us put aside for a moment debates about infection rates, IFRs, modeling, dying from versus dying with, death counts, and juicing the numbers. Let's take a break from shouting at each other about the wisdom of continuing lockdowns. Let's call a time out on our I told you so's, our attacks and self-justifications. Stop looking for someone to blame. China, Trump, Fauci, Republicans, Democrats, the media, Big Pharma, the CDC, whomever. Let the calamity sink in. Worldwide, 250,000 people are dead. Each one a son or daughter, friend and colleague, thousands of brothers and sisters, fathers and mothers, grandfathers and grandmothers. Whether or not it's accurate to say COVID killed them, they're dead. And the toll of loss and sorrow is many times greater than the death toll. Remember that thousands have died without the comfort of family, friends, or pastor at their deathbeds. These are horrors. Think of wives and children locked indoors with their abusers, the depressed for whom isolation squeezes out the last remnants of hope, the sick who deteriorate because they're scared to go to the hospital. Think of restaurant owners who stand to lose the clean, well-lighted places they've been building for decades, the retail sales clerk laid off in middle age, the nurse and doctors deceased in the line of duty. Think of millions huddled in their homes, terrified to venture out. Those two are horrors. Think, feel the sheer wreckage of the past 2 months. Hold that feeling. And sit alone in silence, as Lamentations 3:28 encourages us to do. Silence is something we can do together. If we lose the capacity for shared silence, we've lost our shared humanity. We chatter on because reality is too painful. It's easier to slip into our comfortable ideological slots. Yet we can't be silent forever. Silence we can share. But when we break the silence, can we find a common language? There will be a reckoning. We'll have to assess whether and where we panicked and overreacted, whether and where we were complacently underprepared. Whatever mistakes we've made, we want to avoid repeating them. That reckoning will be contested, as it always is. It will be divisive, as all judgments must be. To be fruitful, the future battle over COVID-19 needs to be something more than a blame game. To approximate truth and reconciliation, it must be bounded by our shared vulnerability and shared sorrow. The church must lead the way, compelled as we are by apostolic mandate to weep with those who weep. Maybe, just maybe, if we lament together now, we can lay the foundations for a more human world where in Auden's haunting words, one could weep because another wept. Myself, I've worried about a lot of different things over the past 2 months. I should be praying about those things more, and I have prayed about those things, but often I worry instead. I have some room to grow, of course. When it comes to our congregation, I've worried about how the illness might affect us. Will congregants get sick? Will congregants die? I've worried about people's financial situations as the economy takes its hits. I've worried about families and marriages with people who've had various levels of tension between them before they were all locked up together every day. I've worried about the church's finances and the school's finances. I've worried about how we'll know what to do next. I've worried about what mistakes we could make. I've prayed, of course, about all those things too, but I've also worried. This week, I scheduled the first meeting of a committee of a few elders, a few deacons, and the ministers of our church who, with the help of our administrator, will begin to work on a plan for how we might approach reopening in the weeks and the months ahead. When we've got our recommendations together, we'll discuss them with the full diaconate and present them to the session, and the officers will make the final decision. I don't know exactly what our timeline will look like, and I'll share our plans for reopening with you once they're all set. In the meantime, I have to ask you to be patient. But as I thought about those plans, a new worry struck me. I worried about how we would love one another as we reopened. Not because I think we have a congregation that is unloving, not that at all. I've seen wonderful acts of love and care and sacrifice in our congregation. But I worry because I think it is going to be difficult. No matter what happens, people will disagree, sometimes strongly, and it will be difficult to love one another well. Some will be frustrated that we're going too slow. Others may be frustrated that they feel we're moving too fast. Some may be frustrated by restrictions and rules we put in place to prevent the spread of disease. Others may be frustrated that we're not doing more or that people aren't following the rules strictly enough. Some will be personally offended by the caution or the lack of caution of others, and will be called to love each other in the midst of those disagreements and those frustrations and those offenses. It's going to be difficult. And so in the midst of all the other worries and concerns, I need to make that chief among my prayers, that we would love one another well in our thoughts, in our hearts, in our words, and also in our deeds. Jesus said to his disciples, "By this all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." Brothers and sisters, let that be so of us. Amen.